Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. Welcome, I'm Jeremy Mags. Coming up on the program, could oil and gas be South Africa's next big economic game changer? A 1 billion rand private push to rescue a key Johannesburg precinct, and why South Africans are spending more on baby products despite falling birth rates. It's Friday, the 20th of February. Now here's a question. Could oil and gas beneath our seabed help fix South Africa's growth and jobs crisis? There's a new report that suggests offshore exploration could boost GDP, create thousands of jobs, and strengthen energy security. But here's the caveat, if done right. Well, joining me now is Dr. Ross Compton, Senior Director of Global Policy at Energeo Alliance, to discuss whether this is genuine economic opportunity or maybe simply optimistic modelling. Ross, a very warm welcome to you. Maybe in simple terms, and let's start with this, how big could oil and gas be for South Africa's economy? How much potential is there?
I think you characterise that correctly. I think there is a big opportunity there, and I think there's a lot of history to exploration in South Africa that backs that up. Exploration has been going on since the early 70s offshore South Africa, and then really more in earnest in the last few years, where projects have been able to get to a stage where we can understand what some of that potential is, and particularly for projects like Block 11B, 12B, and discoveries like Broadpella and so on. We've got a good understanding of the potential that they bring to the fiscus in terms of GDP growth and so on, as well as job creation. And so to use that particular example of Block 11B, 12B, where we've probably got the best estimates of that potential, we think there's a potential contribution to GDP of approximately 23 billion rand annually, which is obviously significant. And in terms of job creation there, it's around about 20,000 jobs within that project alone. And of course, as you look to other projects, places like the Orange Basin, of course, where there's significant de-risking from across the border into Namibia, as well as some exploration on the South African side, the overall job creation within the sector could be as high as 50,000 as those projects are built out over time. And that's a variety of jobs as well. That's across the whole supply chain and lifespan of the project. So that's everything from very, very technical jobs to some unskilled jobs as well. So there's a lot of potential there.
Let me pivot back to jobs in just a moment, but I'll be a little bit skeptical here. In the past, we've heard big promises before. What, in your opinion, makes current opportunity different?
And I think that's really a good caveat there. You know, it's good to be to not overpromise and make sure that the delivery is done correctly. And I think what is being done within South Africa as well as across the border is a real focus on ensuring that local jobs are provided as well. And so that's being built into the regulatory frameworks as much as it is within the governance of the players involved. Some of the international oil companies seeking very much to work with local suppliers and to build out the workforce using local personnel. And I think that's really important going forward. But I think this isn't necessarily about over-promising. I think, we're focusing on those projects where we've got the best understanding and there's still a lot of work to do. So to understand that broader potential, it requires further exploration, ultimately. Although, as I say, work has been going on since the early 70s. There's a lot more to do. You know, we don't have full coverage in a lot of areas. So we need modern data, modern geophysical data to fully understand the subsurface and what the potential is. So it's really important to get those projects going, to build out an understanding and to build that investment potential for companies to take the plunge.
You mentioned the jobs trajectory, but how many real jobs are we talking about? And perhaps more importantly, for how long?
So if you think about the lifespan of these projects, it takes some time to get going. So the early stages of exploration, to be realistic, they don't provide a great deal of local opportunity. It's once you collect that data, you analyze what's there, you've got a good understanding of the subsurface, and companies move towards those next phases of exploratory drilling and then ultimately into production. And so once they're building out infrastructure and producing hydrocarbons, then there's a lot more job creation right across the supply chain in supporting those activities, whether that's offshore, whether that's onshore, and supplying all of the necessary materials and provisions and so on, and of course transporting those fuels from wherever they need to get to. So there is a lot within that, and the lifespan itself, through to decommissioning, is anywhere sort of 25, 30 years, and can be more. And of course that's a rolling situation all the time, as different projects are brought online and other projects are wound down over time. So it is a long process. And I think the important thing here, to your point on longevity, is to ensure that those skills are transferable. And a lot of the skills within the oil and gas sector in particular are transferable, including building on the supply chains and skills that are already in South Africa. We're not talking about starting from scratch. Of course, South Africa's got a long history with mining, for example, and the coal sector. It's not to say that it's an immediate switch for the workforce. But there are a lot of transferable skills. And then if you look at the energy mix going forward, and the energy evolution, bringing online different renewables projects, whether they be onshore wind, offshore wind, other projects like hydrogen and so on, they rely on a lot of the same skills, whether that's engineering, whether that's geology and geophysics, all of those sorts of things. So we are talking about a real injection of skills into the workforce, and I think there is a long-term potential there across different parts of that energy sector, and I do think it should be considered as an energy sector more holistically rather than just focusing on oil and gas or coal or anything in isolation.
Right. And I'm going to finish with a very, and I'll need a very quick answer. Realistically, and maybe I should have started with this, could domestic oil and gas really bring down electricity costs or fuel prices?
That's a hard one to answer, to be honest. I think it has the potential. Yes, it has the potential. But there's a lot of factors to that, because it relies on grid being built out. It relies on infrastructure being built. But certainly having that domestic supply has that potential to do so, because you're not reliant on imports and the whims of geopolitical situations and potential supplies drying up and that sort of thing. So yes, I think it has the potential to contribute significantly to the security of Africa's supply, South Africa's supply, and also being positive for the impact on individuals and what they pay for their electricity in the longer term.
Thank you very much indeed, Dr. Ross Compton, Senior Director of Global Policy at Energeo Alliance. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, I see that Johannesburg's infrastructure crisis is now forcing the private sector to step in. A coalition of major property players says it's ready to mobilize as much as R1 billion to rescue Linbro Park. It's a strategic 400-hectare precinct along the Randburg OR Tambo corridor. After years of failing roads, drainage collapse, and unreliable power and water. But I think it's fair to ask this question: is it visionary urban renewal, or maybe just a symptom of a city that simply can't keep up? In conversation now with Jenny Rose, chairperson of the Linbro Park Management District. Jenny, a very warm welcome to you. And maybe let's just start off bluntly. Is this an ambitious development story we're talking about, or just a rescue mission because the city of Johannesburg can't keep up, as I've said, has simply failed?
Thank you, Jeremy. This is actually, I think, more of a rescue mission at this point in time. There's a lot of money that has been developed and put into the area. However, it's been piecemeal development without one single driver. Previously, the city would be the driver, making sure that the roads are in place, and that hasn't happened.
So what exactly are you rescuing, do you think?
Well, we're rescuing the area. The area is strategic. It's known as the OR Tambo-Randburg Corridor, and it's the largest tract of undeveloped land in Sandton and Joburg Central. So really, it's the last place where we can still develop. There's opportunities for residential and for commercial, and money has been invested. However, we can't get through from a traffic point of view. We need to rescue areas and roads for the Gautrain and the Rea Vaya, which are also supposed to travel through Limbo Park.
And Jenny, when you've raised your concerns with the city of Johannesburg, what kind of response do you get?
Well, you know, Jeremy, we sort of have taken the shortest route to trying to find a solution. And we found somebody really good to work with. It's Liana Stradom in the city. She's the assistant director of the Eastern Region for Regional Planning. And she has been absolutely wonderful. So receptive. She's taken the bull by the horns, and she's going to help us through the process of meeting with the various departments and short-circuit the process in terms of getting things in place.
So Jenny, you say up to R1 billion is needed. That is a king's ransom. So who ultimately is paying for this? Is it developers, institutional investors, or residents perhaps through higher property costs?
So it definitely can't be the residents. We're all sort of stretched to the maximum limit at this point in time. And traditionally, it should have been the city that would have put the infrastructure in place. However, as we know, that's not possible. And we are one of many, many, many problems that the city has. So by taking matters into our own hands, we're going to start looking for a blended sort of financial solution. There is the Infrastructure South Africa Fund as one of those, which is partly managed and flows through the IDC and DBSA. And the other side is we're going to be looking towards companies such as Future Growth, who has an infrastructure bond. And then we will also put into the mix development funding that needs to come automatically if one is looking at building in any city. One needs to put in a contribution towards development. So it'll be a blended mix.
Jenny, you talk about taking matters into your own hands, and I do acknowledge that, but are you also effectively creating a privately managed enclave inside a struggling metro?
We're trying to do that. At this point, we're trying to have a look at one unified vision, partly to protect the investment that has already gone into the area and partly to unlock potential and opportunity that is still there. It is in a private initiative completely and not governed by any city or city rail taxes at all. It really is an initiative that's been put in place by the developers in the area and is mandated by an MOU that's been signed.
Jenny, it is risky, though, because the city of Johannesburg faces a 220 billion rand infrastructure backlog. You must be confident that municipal coordination is not going to stall like so many other projects. I understand that you have inroads into the council, but this does have a degree of risk, does it not?
As long as we get sign-off and cooperation from the city, which I do believe we will get, I think there's very little risk.
What about roads, drainage, water and electricity as far as their neglect is concerned? If you were to do an audit, which one is currently the biggest red flag and what needs immediate attention and priority?
Well, our biggest red flag is the main road through Limbo Park. It's called Cluley Road. One actually needs a 4x4. To get down that road. I think it's one of the worst looking roads in Johannesburg, sadly. So definitely the roads are the first one to flag. What we are going to do as well is do a major cleanup on the verges and ensure that our security is connected as a network into the whole area. And then from there, keep an eye on the water tower that is making good progress. I don't have a current update, but I do believe that the water tower is now in construction phase. Or consultation phase, we need to just check on that. And then electricity. Electricity is a restriction in the area for many, many reasons. Mm. So we need to also just keep an eye on seeing how we can get additional electricity into the area.
And if funding doesn't materialize, what happens? Does the development freeze?
Well, yeah, that would be a sad moment if funding doesn't materialize. But yes, it would actually, because nobody's going to put their money into the ground to develop anymore when we're already battling with the infrastructure that exists.
And on the flip side, though, if it does materialize, would you see this as a blueprint for other Johannesburg nodes facing similar problems?
Absolutely. I think this would be a prime example of how public-private partnership could work together in order to put a vision into action and materialize the goal.
And just finally, you've got to ensure that a project like this, should it materialize, doesn't widen the inequality gap between well-resourced precincts and the rest of the city. How would you do that?
Well, I don't think it would widen the gap, because I do think we would create more employment with our neighbor, you know, utilizing the very good source next door, being Alex. There's a lot of people looking for work in Alex, and we have a lovely connecting corridor into Limber Park. So there'd be a lot of work created. I do not doubt that it would be beneficial to the city as opposed to distracting or detracting from other areas.
Jenny Rose, thank you very much indeed. Chairperson of the Limber Park Management District.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, with just days to go before the 2026 national budget, the stakes, I think, could hardly be higher. Growth remains sluggish at just over 1% in real terms. Debt sits close to 78% of GDP. And government is facing new spending pressures, from infrastructure funding to the extension of the SRD grant, and also the fallout from US aid funding cuts. Now, at the same time, National Treasury has got to defend its fiscal credibility after South Africa's long-awaited ratings upgrade last year. As I say, the stakes couldn't be higher. In conversation now with Lulu Kruchel, who is Chief Economist and Sustainability Leader at PwC South Africa, let's see what we can expect from the Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana next week. Lulu, welcome to you. So real GDP 1.2%, just give us the broad canvas here. Is that growth or just economic drift?
Yeah, Jeremy, the reality is, unfortunately, with growth sitting under the 2% mark, we're basically just, you know, moving sideways, and we don't see any real progress in reducing unemployment. We don't see any real momentum to change people's livelihoods. Of course, growth is not the only thing that we need to do that, but it's one of the strongest levers that we can pull, because it creates the fiscal space and the ability to do that, and also for private sector to invest in new capacity, expand their plans, etc. So we at PwC are generally a little bit more pessimistic, not significantly so, than the numbers that we see coming out from National Treasury. But the reality is that neither the forecast that will probably come from National Treasury or our own of growth of around 1.2 going to about 1.5% by 2028 will be sufficient. So we do need to change.
So let's talk then about investment potential against that backdrop. Your suggestion then also is that consolidation remains on track. That's good, but at a slower pace than Treasury is anticipating. How worried then should investors be about that gap?
Well, I think the reality is that we are planning for a third year of a primary surplus on the budget. From my tax colleagues, I understand that the tax collection numbers are looking positive. So I think we do have a little bit of room for maneuvering. And the fact that we are, yes, we are maybe not meeting the exact targets that Treasury has put out there, but we're trending in the right direction, and you mentioned our first credit upgrade in two decades. All of that is telling a story of investors, or that should hopefully tell investors, listen, what we're saying is okay, but the WEF's latest global risk report said we are living in an age of competition like never before. So we cannot expect the world outside to look at South Africa and say, oh, we like you, South Africa. At the end of the day, it's about where is my money going to make the most returns? And that is unfortunately the reality that we need to deal with. So I think investors should actually take heart if they look at South Africa. We've been removed from the grey list as well. Load shedding has improved. We've done a lot of good things. But it's not yet enough to really make us a compelling story for them if they look for places to put their money.
And Lulu, it's all about revenue, and you reference tax. So Treasury, if I've got this number correct, penciling in around 20 billion rand in unspecified tax hikes. Where does that come from? And given that the tax revenue forecast is below Treasury's projection, that obviously narrows the fiscal space even further, doesn't it?
Yeah, so to be brutally honest, when they penciled it in, I think it was still in the back of their minds, you know, will it be a VAT increase? They were hoping to give SARS a bit of money to collect additional revenue. But the reality is SARS is not, and that is from people that were supposed to be in the tax net. That's not. And SARS has not really made big progress there. When we looked at the January tax collection numbers, it is looking a little bit more positive, and it looks like we might end the year, fiscal year, around 30 billion up from what was in the MTBPS. So that will allow Treasury room, at least for this year, to say, listen, we probably don't need to hike taxes like VAT. They don't have room on the personal income tax base. There will be a couple of small things here and there that they would tweak. So it will probably, you know, except for some very minor changes, we don't foresee that they would need to do major things this year, but it is just buying them a bit of time. The reality is we, over the medium term, have to look at additional tax collections, and that will need to come from growth in essence.
Lulu, let me try and counter that if I can. What is of concern is the SRD grant extension. That's almost 40 billion rand a year. Surely that is not fiscally sustainable without tax increases.
The reality is that maybe a little bit of a windfall that we're seeing from company taxes at the moment because of, and by the way, it's not as much as we anticipated, but from the mining industry on the result of very strong commodity prices is buying us a bit of time. But as you rightfully say, none of that are long-term changes in trajectory. And as I said, growth is the only thing that could really put us on a long-term sustainable fiscal path. And then combined with that is continuing getting people into the tax net that should be in the tax net. From what I understand, again, and this is what my tax colleagues explained to me, there's around 400 billion per year that should be collected on a yearly basis from, you know, tax evasion, actually. And that is not currently happening. SARS has made massive inroads in that regard. There's about an extra 400 billion that's sitting in SARS's or on SARS's account that, you know, it's people you owe us money and it will come in at some point. But there's an additional 400 billion that should come in every year. And that actually dwarfs some of the shortfalls that we're talking about. So if we get that right, and if the economy grows and tax buoyancy has been picking up a little bit, it's around 1.1. So it means for every 1% that GDP grows, there's a 1.1 percentage point increase in tax collections. That's actually not bad. It's a little bit better than we were a couple of years ago. But the reality is these longer term expenditure items like the SDR, we can't just continue kicking the ball down the road because we're taking money away from other areas that's needed for economic growth.
And then, of course, there's the black swan debate, isn't there? We've got global trade tension, and the budget in one way or another is always potentially going to be exposed to geopolitical shock.
Yeah, I think that is the biggest challenge at the moment. Again, to reference the WEF's Global Risk Report, they had geopolitical confrontation as their number one risk this year. So, you know, people and state-based conflicts number two. So what they're basically saying is countries are going to pull, different. I'm going to use the word stunts, actually, although I don't think in every case it's a stunt. In some cases it's a stunt, and others it's a reaction to the stunt. But to actually, you know, bring each other in line and to get the geopolitical outputs that they can. So they're using economic ways of doing that, and we've seen that from the US and from President Trump with the tariffs. And South Africa has long said, but we are neutral, we are a non-aligned country. And the reality is that at least the US is not buying that. And is it, in my opinion, wrong? Yes, but that doesn't change the reality of what we're dealing with. And that can really change very quickly. And as we've seen, you know, has massive impact on the value of the rand at the moment. Things are going our way. But it could easily also turn around and go in a different direction, which we don't know.
There is no doubt it's going to be a very interesting week ahead. Lulu Kruchel, thank you very much indeed. Chief Economist and Sustainability Leader at PwC South Africa.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, South Africa's birth rate is declining and household finances remain under pressure. So you would expect baby product sales to be shrinking, but in fact not. There's new data from Trade Intelligence that shows categories like formula, nappies and baby food are still growing strongly. So let's try and join the disconnect if we can. I'm in conversation with Andrea Slubber, who's Insights Lead at Trade Intelligence. This is so interesting, Andrea, and welcome to you. So birth rates falling, where then is the product growth coming from?
I think it's important to have a look at the baby category and move the lens of the wellness trend. So many people are much more aware of wellness needs across personal care and health, and especially when it comes to babies. So I think the access to information, social media plays a big role where information is shared. So there's just so much more awareness of products and benefits that I think moms are engaging with. And prioritizing spend on baby is definitely something that families are definitely committed to.
So if they're prioritizing spend, it also suggests, does it not, that parents are maybe spending more per child, or maybe they're simply paying higher prices, or maybe both?
I think it's a bit of both. Certainly some of the categories have been impacted by inflation, especially around food, not so much the personal care category as food. And there are some categories that are highly vulnerable and high cost items, for example, baby formula, which obviously is hugely impacted. So I think it is spending more per child because of inflation in some cases, but also in terms of prioritizing spend.
So let me pick you up on formula. I was unaware that it couldn't be advertised or discounted. How do retailers then compete in that space?
Such a good question. Stock availability. If there's one thing you need to get right in retail, it's on-shelf availability. Across the baby categories, you know, if you look at food, formula, personal care and nappies, the one category where brand loyalty is the strongest is with formula. And it's based on trust and efficacy of those products. So although advertising is not allowed, the healthcare communities certainly support moms in ensuring that they buy a high quality formula. And our research shows that if a mom cannot find, or the caregiver can't find, the product that they're looking for in one particular store, they will not switch brands, they will switch the store that they buy from. So brand loyalty should really, to answer your question, it's really all about the product that the mother wants.
It's about the product the mother wants, which also tells me that is fundamentally a supply chain strategy issue, isn't it?
Absolutely. And there are things you can control and things you can't control. I mean, supply chains have been disrupted over the past few years by a number of different factors. So certainly that is the number one priority, both for suppliers and for retailers, to ensure availability of their products.
Andrea, let's talk a little bit about loyalty. That's interesting. Your research also tells me that private label penetration is extremely high. In fact, that's not just in the baby category, but we've discussed this in the past. It's across a multiplicity of categories. Do you think that it's become now a permanent structural shift in brand power, given the penetration and the efficacy of private label products?
Definitely. I mean, we've seen year-on-year growth in private brand share in shoppers' baskets. In wellness, the wider wellness category, definitely very strong. Within baby, like I've said, the formula category is quite resilient in terms of brands being preferred by the leading brands preferred by the mothers or caregivers. But when it comes to personal care and food, and particularly nappies, private label share has grown a lot.
So it also says that national brands are fighting more for emotional category, and as you're suggesting, not just in the baby category, but across the whole FMCG continuum.
Definitely. I mean, the fight and the competition is fierce between the retailers, I suppose, and the suppliers. You know, they work together, they collaborate. But if I look at what's happened in the nappy category years ago, I think moms would have been motivated to stick to the big brands for efficacy and product quality. Certainly, the retailers have upped their game, and they have improved the quality of nappies to such an extent. I mean, Click said that in 2023, one out of every four nappies sold in their stores were private label. By 2025, it's one out of every two. So half the nappies sold in Clicks are private label. So they've certainly earned the trust of mothers, because product quality when it comes to nappies is really important, and it's obviously a high investment product.
Which interestingly would maybe redefine the term premium and what it actually means.
Definitely. Gosh, premiumization is a topic that we often discuss, and what's happening in retail is so interesting because the retailers are intentionally premiumizing their store experience, the product offering, etc. So they are improving quality. They're also ensuring that the product packaging is signaling the premium quality messages to shoppers. Certainly, in some cases, you can argue that the leading brand still leads in terms of the actual quality, but it's up to the shopper to decide what product that they want to buy. So retailers are really giving stiff competition to trusted leading brands in some of the baby categories.
Am I correct, Andrea, in saying, though, that it's slightly different when it comes to baby food? Your research, if I've read this correctly, seems to split between affordability and aspiration. If that's the case, it would be creating what I think the market has called a two-speed market.
Definitely. We see such exciting innovation happening in terms of food, and certainly it creates a wonderful opportunity for new suppliers and also then for existing brands to expand ranges. And certainly on the other side, the retailer private label is focused on offering good value. And, you know, if you look at the discount structures these days with retailers that they offer, then certainly from the private brand perspective, and also just in terms of discounting to attract foot traffic into their store, is a big strategy.
So just a final one and a quick answer. If income is going to remain under pressure in 2026, and it will, where do you think future growth in the sector is going to come from?
I do believe that if we look once again, take a step back and look at the wellness industry, it's often spoken of as a very defensive category or channel. And, you know, because shoppers prioritize spend around the wellness needs. And when it comes to baby, even more so. So despite the fact that household budgets are under pressure, these categories, I think, will continue to perform well. Mm.
Andrea, I've just got one thing to say to you. I am very pleased that my two daughters are now adults, because this is a very complicated market. Thank you for joining me. And that's our program for today and for the week. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.